Hello and welcome to the Blue Plaque Pod. My guest today is Ian Dunt, who is a British author, political journalist and broadcaster. He is a columnist for The Eye and has previously been editor of politics.co.uk and a columnist for The New European. He hosts the Origin Story podcast with Dorian Lynskey, and he's the author of How to Be a Liberal, Brexit, What the Hell Happens Now, and How Westminster Works and Why It Doesn't. Welcome.
Thank you. I mean, when you say them like that, I just sort of think the next book cannot have the word how in the title, or else it just looks like I've turned into a sort of like an IKEA version of political instruction. But there we are.
Yeah, maybe move to why. Just
why not? Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So this is a podcast about blue plaques. So could you introduce yourself in the style of a blue plaque? So first thing we need to know is where this plaque is going to be. It's got to be somewhere that means something to you. Is it your birthplace, your childhood home? Where are we?
I find that very hard to answer because I don't feel a lot of connection. This sounds like a weird thing to say. I don't feel like a huge amount of connection with the places that I've lived. It would necessarily be in North London, quite close to Hampstead Heath, which is where I live and where I do most of my socializing and most of my working. And because you're freelance, basically where the entirety of your life revolves. I mean, I want the answer to be Soho because that's where I feel most kind of at home. But the truth is that I don't live there, so I guess I don't get to make that claim. Can you have plaques for where you drink? Does it have to be where you live?
I mean, so I think, you know, the official London rules are that it has to be somewhere really significant. But I've definitely seen ones outside the UK, like, you know, like Dickens stayed in this hotel for two nights.
Oh, right,
and
yeah.
There's one at Manchester Airport for Yuri Gagarin, who landed there once. So I feel, you know, a place where you feel really at home and where you drink regularly, I think that counts. I think you can have that. So, you know, if that is where you want your blue plaque to be.
That's good. It's the same with Hemingway, isn't it? I feel like I've gone to at least four bars around the world that they say, oh, this is the bar where Hemingway used to drink and where he had mojitos or something. And you sort of think, like, did he really drink in all these bars, or is this just something that people do in order to gain more clientele?
When I went to Cuba, I went to a bar and they had a sign on the wall that said Ernest Hemingway didn't drink here, which I quite enjoyed. So we've sort of established where your blue plaque is. It finds itself on the wall of a watering hole in Soho. I mean, obviously, blue plaques are quite small, so you only got a few words. How would you describe yourself?
Oh, God. Just a hack?
Just one word, hack.
Hack, yeah, hack, drank here. I'd be very happy with that, actually. I'd be very proud of that.
Now that we've got your blue plaque sorted, we're now going to visit, figuratively at least, the plaque that you've chosen to talk about, which is the one for John Stuart Mill. And this is also in London. It's at 18 Kensington Square in South Kensington. And it says, John Stuart Mill, 1806 to 1873, philosopher, lived here. And it was erected in 1907 by the London County Council, which means that it's one of the really beautiful ones with a kind of wreath of leaves around the outside. And it's a really beautiful kind of green colour. I admitted to you that this is really not my specialist subject, and I don't know all that much about John Stuart Mill. So I said, unfortunately, you're going to have to do quite a lot of the heavy lifting, and you're probably going to spend a lot of the next half hour politely saying, yes, you could put it that way, but but I'm going to endeavour to give a sort of a brief biography, and you can probably correct me. So John Stuart Mill is a British philosopher, a political economist and social reformer and politician. He had a huge impact on 19th century thought, and his ideas on politics, society, ethics and philosophy are still really influential. He was a proponent of utilitarianism, which was developed by his godfather, Jeremy Bentham, and he was a champion of individual liberty and an early supporter of women's suffrage. Can I ask you why you chose this plaque?
I think that the ideas of Mill and his wife, Harriet Taylor, they really functioned as a joint intellectual partnership. She got written out of history afterwards, but they wrote their books together, the most important books together. Hold the key not just to political truth, to the freedom of individuals in society and to the triumph of liberalism, but they also hold the key to how to live your own life, to live according to yourself and not the pressure to conform that is placed on you by society and by the state, to try and give yourself the strength to live the life that you want to lead and to resist the kind of smothering temptations of just conforming to what other people want of your life. So really, on a personal and a political level, they're some of the most important intellectual contributions to human history that we've ever known. And they just so happen to live in a quite a nice house in London.
The time at which he lived, you know, he was born in May 1806 and died in 1873, age 66. But this was sort of a period of Industrial Revolution, and the time in which he lived and the place in which he lived had a huge impact, because it was quite revolutionary at the time, but he was also trying to think about the ways in which, you know, industrialization and industrial thought and people who were involved in the Industrial Revolution. He was sort of very much of his time, and his time shaped his ideas. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it's hard with him, you know, because he had a bruising childhood. He was, it's kind of a childhood unlike anyone, any other, really. His father, James Mill, and Jeremy Bentham, who you mentioned, this sort of really towering utilitarian figures, used him as almost like a sort of child experiment. They wanted to create the perfect human calculation machine. Mill described himself, or the product they tried to create, as a dry, hard logic machine. They deprived him of contact with any other children. They set him what was described sort of later as the most disciplined study regime ever introduced to a child. Sort of like, you know, learning ancient Greek at the age of 4, reading Aristotle at the age of 11. And it was all designed to just turn him into this utilitarian calculus engine without any real emotional connections at all. And so he's slightly of his time. I mean, obviously, he's grappling with the ideas of his time. If we were to talk about his relationship to imperialism, for instance, we would not like the answers that we found. I mean, at the time, he would be a radical. He wanted colonialism to end. But he would have said, well, we've got to stick around long enough until people are capable of governing themselves. So we wouldn't love those answers. He's of his time. In other ways, his moral and his intellectual calculations were way ahead of their time. So if you look at the positions he held on feminism and women's rights, I mean, they were over 100 years ahead of their time, really, in terms of the radicalism that he was proposing. This wasn't just votes for women. He was talking about the way that women's minds were, they were being forced into a form of submissive social personality by a patriarchal society. It was the kind of things that you would hear from radical feminists in the 60s, in the 70s, let alone anything that you would hear in the 1920s. Certainly, let alone the Victorian period. So he's sort of almost too odd to place in a historical time because of the way he was brought up and because of the man that he was.
So one of the things, I mean, again, blue plaques are all about brevity and people's experiences of them as you walk past, particularly if it's someone, a name you don't really know, you have this kind of brief glimpse and just a few words in which to express their importance. So what I try and do in this podcast is to sort of pick out three either turning points or key moments in someone's life, or three things about them that I think help sum them up. I did think, you know, you've already touched a little bit on his family, but it seemed like this was absolutely key to understanding who he is. You know, his father was the Scottish philosopher James Mill. And as he already said, he was a real disciplinarian and devised this curriculum for his son. He also kind of lied to him about his educational achievements and his knowledge compared to other children. You know, from what I've read, he basically told him that he was sort of behind other children, despite the fact that by the time he was 8, he was reading, you know, Aesop's Fables in the original Greek and was busy devouring the rest of the classics, you know, which is really astonishing. And so this had a huge impact on him, but also the fact that, you know, as you say, in this kind of educational experiment, he was being taught directly by his father. But then part of this experiment was that he had to go on and teach his siblings. He was part of a large family. I think he had 7 or 8 siblings, and he had to teach them, and he would be punished for their mistakes. And he had this odd relationship with his mother. You know, he would later say that he didn't have a, you know, essentially didn't have a great relationship with her, and they had this stunted relationship. But he tacitly blamed that on his father by, you know, indicating that he, that his father had sort of forced his mother into a role where she couldn't develop herself, and therefore the relationship between her and her children was similarly stunted. And so this family upbringing seems to be absolutely pivotal to a lot of his later ideas about politics, individual liberty, and so on and so forth.
It's like his life is this constant struggle for human warmth, for something outside of the logic machine. And it doesn't always succeed. You know, when he talks about that education with his dad, he said in his autobiography, he said, "I thus grew up in the absence of love and in the presence of fear." For the entirety of his childhood, when you see the sort of reports of his first friends, and these are people he met in debating societies in London when he was about 20 years old, they can see he's clearly a genius, but he's socially, he's basically a child. And they say specifically, Roebuck says, and particularly around women, he knew absolutely nothing. You know, he was just broken, really. And there's this yearning for him. I mean, really, the crucial point, you know, to me is in the winter of 1826, because that's when he has a nervous breakdown in a way that you would obviously presume someone would after that kind of upbringing. He completely falls apart to the point he's suicidal. So he's doing suicidal ideation. He sets himself a timetable for when he will commit suicide unless something improves. And the thing that gives him life is really poetry, specifically Wordsworth, although Shelley as well, to a lesser extent. And poetry had been sort of dismissed by Bentham, by his father, as the sort of frivolous mendacity. And he's just like, well, actually, this gives me a feeling in my heart, in my goddamn heart, you know, which no one else had bothered to spend any time thinking about. It gave him a reason to live. And that journey, which is, you know, the poetry is the first moment that there's the kindling, that there's a bit of fire. That really, I think, is the story of his life. And it's not an entirely happy one, because even when we go to his autobiography, he writes right at the end of his life, the published version lacks any kind of human content whatsoever. And it was only later, when we in the 1960s, when we discovered his notes for it, that we found him trying to introduce that aspect. So he wrote page after page, section after section, about how he was physically unable to even do up a tie, let alone any kind of sport, because he'd never played with anyone when he was a child. And then eventually just deleted it all and said, you know, I hence was always to a certain degree incompetent in manual tasks. So you see the strength of feeling underneath that kind of quite dry, hard exterior.
There's a quote from a female diarist who visited the family home after the death of his father. So in the 1830s, this diarist, Caroline Fox, visits the family home where he lives with his mother and his siblings. And she writes about his charming library, the mother so anxious to show everything and her son so terribly afraid of boring us. That breaks my heart. It's really just such a sad reflection on a childhood devoid of so many of the things that childhood should be rich in. Mm. The second thing that I wanted to pinpoint out of my three is his work, is his sort of day job, and the tension that I think exists now when we're sort of thinking about commemoration and thinking about him as a person. You know, he for, you know, half his life, he was working at India House, essentially. He starts off age 17. He doesn't go into university. He starts off as a junior clerk in the examiner's office of India House. And then after his father's death, he was put in charge of the British East India Company's relations with the Indian states. And eventually he becomes the head of the examiner's office. And this is a bit of a sort of, it seems to me, a bit of a sticky bit in his biography, because he thinks a lot about individual liberty and he's sort of really known for that. And yet he defends the company's government of India. And that seems to me to kind of echo the struggle he has and the way that he grapples with ideas about individual liberty versus the state. And I wondered if that was something that you had thoughts on, or whether that was something that you would choose as something significant if we're thinking about him now.
I don't think it's significant. He is a bundle of surprising and unsurprising elements. I think the imperialist element is sort of the least surprising. And where he finds himself is this, what would it's essentially the centrist position of the time, which was, you know, against pulling out of everywhere instantly, but for an end in the medium term of British imperialism, which involved, you know, building up what they called the educational aspects of the indigenous population to the point where they were capable, in their words, of self-government. So again, it's completely like appalling to us with modern ears. We are just not, I mean, this is an obvious point to make, but it does turn out that we need to make it all the time. We are not going to find anyone in the 1800s who is speaking in the manner that we would speak now and has the kind of values that we have now. So it's true that he was quite slow, and it's probably the worst of his opinions on imperialism. In other areas, we see him pushing very hard, for instance, against racism. So unlike, and this is kind of staggering, most British liberals were on the side of the South in the American Civil War. They didn't see it as an issue of individual liberty, although it's concerning slavery, the most obvious affront to individual liberty that you can imagine. They saw it as a question of self-determination for the Southern states. John Stuart Mill was, I mean, I think he would quite, I think there'd be a pretty good consensus on that among historians, would be one of the intellectual leaders of the British sort of pro-North view in London. The same way any kind of crime committed in Jamaica, he was intrinsic in trying to bring together opposition and searching for convictions on that. He was actually, on most racial issues, quite startlingly ahead of his time and ahead of certainly his friendship group and how he discussed it. So, you know, you take his stuff in the round in that area and you think, yeah, slightly disappointing, certainly within the further realms of progressiveness in terms of the society that he was in, and way beyond the normal realms of progressiveness in the society that he was in when it came to questions of race and slavery at the time.
So if that isn't something that you would pick up as a kind of key to understanding him, I suppose, you know, the third thing that I've chosen is his relationship with Harriet Taylor and their marriage in 1851. I'm going to move on to that. But if what would you choose as your kind of second key point about Mill that people should know?
Oh, the same. I'm in the same place as you. So it's Harriet. But the thing, I think, you know, that relationship starts in 1830, and most of it takes place before they're married, and when she is in fact married to another man. That's when they do most of their most important work together. And that's when really I think what they carry out is probably the most beautiful love story in the history of ideas. You know, at the point that you, when they meet, she has two children. She has a third on the way. She's stuck in this kind of loveless marriage, but not a terrible marriage. I mean, Thomas Carlyle describes her husband as an innocent, dull, good man, like a way that no man really wants to be described that way, but nevertheless.
Or woman. That's very, very faint praise.
It's faint praise, but you know, this is the thing, right? They didn't want to hurt him. He wasn't a bastard, you know.
So the equivalent of saying to someone now, you're alive and you're not dreadful.
Yes, which, you know, plenty of human, I mean, I work in Westminster, so plenty of human beings fail to satisfy the benchmark that you have just set. and he has just coming out of that nervous breakdown. You know, this is just a few years after he discovers poetry and finds a reason to live. The relationship is really fraught. It's really difficult. Like, there's a point early on where she clearly tries to break it up. We presume, we don't know because we don't have those letters, but we presume because her husband demanded it. And suddenly, you know, even from the way he writes to her, all of that dry, hard logic machine goes away. Like, I mean, at one point, in response to that letter breaking it up, he writes, "At whatever time, in whatever place that I may be so, she will find me always the same as I have been, as I am now." Now, I'm not claiming that for the most beautiful poetry in the world, but for that to come from the person who had just repaired themselves from being the dry, hard logic machine, I think is quite a beautiful moment. And then there's the way that their philosophy is sort of the result of these bizarre living arrangements that they come to. She eventually decides she's going to go to Paris and she's going to make a decision. Is it her husband or is it Mill? You know, who will she stay with? And she comes back and says, oh, you know, I can't make this decision. If I leave my husband, he will be socially shamed in Victorian society forever, because the rules on divorce meant that she would have lost like access to her children, any property, etc. She said, I can't do it, but I refuse to give up on Mill. So instead, we're going to set up this arrangement where my husband remains the social face of the marriage and he maintains his social status and his reputation. But the intimate part of the marriage will be with Mill. And that's how they live for decades, like this extraordinary thing. And of course, society in London loses its mind with innuendo and with gossip. Carlyle calls it the clack of tongues, which I think is probably the best description of gossip that has ever been written. And it forces them to retreat, eventually sort of out of the centre of London, but also to retreat from London's social life. They have that hatred of the twitch of the curtain, of the person who just wants to get involved in your life, and this worship and love of eccentricity and of living according to your own terms as much as possible. So from that union, from that relationship that he is desperately holding on to because it's a kind of meaning of warmth of a human heart in the world, comes all of the best elements of political liberalism.
And it also seems to me that his relationship with Harriet and that kind of meeting of minds, you know, really advances his thinking in particular areas. And I think, you know, he says that he was helped towards his third stage as a political economist. And I love that he thinks of his life as stages of political economy. He said he was helped towards this third stage by her, and that, you know, it's very clear that she has an influence on his thinking with regards to women's rights, and that this becomes kind of part of his political drive in the later part of his life. And she also has a big impact on his on Liberty, which is published in after she dies in 1859. I think his thinking about women's rights, as you say, it's just so ahead of its time. But also sort of seems to me that his relationship with her takes him back in a way to thinking about his mother and the kind of the stunted life that she led.
Oh, that's interesting. I think he's probably too generous to Harriet on political economy. Like when you read her writings, she's not very interesting on political economy. And in fact, when we look at the drafts and her revisions of his work on political economy, she really adds a chapter on sort of class politics, which isn't very good. I think it's probably a little bit overly loving for him to give her too much credit on the political economy. On feminism, he was a feminist before he met her. He one day found a sort of an embryo in a London park, which is clearly the result of a backstreet abortion, and actually ended up in jail for promoting the use of contraceptives in a campaign. That was before he met her. So he had that in him, definitely. She really held his feet to the fire, though. And I think she added a layer of radicalism to his assessment, which is really where it feels strikingly modern. Like when you read them, I can't stress this enough, it is not just about the vote. It is profound. Like what they're talking about is women reduced to a biological function, you know, to the act of sex and the results of sex, to reproduction, and their entire social personality being molded through submissiveness into that function. So it doesn't just work for women's rights. It's an expression of the most radical limits of what liberalism can do. And in fact, he is the first person. He becomes an MP after she dies. He's terrible at being an MP. But he does introduce the first amendment putting women's suffrage ahead in front of the Commons. And actually, about 50 years after that point, it loses. But I think it's in 1928, when women's votes are accepted in the Commons, Millicent Fawcett is there watching from the public gallery. And the first thing she does is walk to the statue of Mill in Embankment and put a flower in his memory. So the work that Harriet Taylor and John Stuart Mill do at that moment is the starting seed that leads towards votes for women about half a century later.
In the years since John Stuart Mill dies, it seems that he has suffered the fate of many great thinkers, in which, you know, their words are quoted out of context to support ideas and positions that they would have passionately disagreed with. And I know that you've picked up on some of these in various Twitter rants. What has been the most egregious, you know, theft of Mill's words that you can think of?
I mean, I would, it's not really a theft of the word, but it is this phrase, classical liberal. That now, I think if you see that in someone's Twitter bio or even if they just say, oh, I'm a classical liberal, what you're about to hear are the words of someone who 99% of the time is not a liberal and does not know what liberalism is. There is, by the way, no classical liberalism. And insofar as there is, if you look at someone like Locke or Adam Smith, they have very, very left-wing, very critical appraisals of the market, just as they do the state. And it was the same with John Stuart Mill. Basically said, like, there is nothing, we cannot come up with an answer for the market versus the state. The state and the market will do different things well. Now it's been adopted by these kind of laissez-faire types who like to talk about freedom of speech, but they had absolutely no grounding in why Mill and Taylor made free speech such an issue, but also asked of people for free speech. In On Liberty, what they were talking about was trying to find the half-truth in your opponent's argument. It was having not just confidence to go into a great big battle of ideas with a capital B and a capital I, the shouting, know-nothing, rocks hitting each other, vacuous nonsense that you'll see on a TV current affairs program every day. It was also having the humility to think that you might actually be wrong. You know, that you could be wrong about things, that your opponent might actually have some element of truth in what they say, some modesty, some vulnerability, intellectual vulnerability in you. That is the kind of free speech that they were promoting. And the things that I see, this tepid, tribalistic, right-wing, free market use of the word classical liberalism that has nothing to do with him, and he would have detested them if he'd known the way that they use the phrase.
What do you think he would make of the way that he's been, you know, of this blue plaque, essentially, of the way he's been commemorated? And would this plaque in this place, what would it mean to him, if anything?
I don't think it would mean very much. He wasn't an arrogant man, but he wasn't under any illusions as to the extent of his intellectual capability. I think he would have been broadly unsurprised that he was considered worth remembering. He would have thought, yeah, no, that makes sense.
But he wasn't arrogant.
in this tradition, you could find someone like John Maynard Keynes. I mean, every quote about John Maynard Keynes is John Maynard Keynes walking into a room and being like, well, obviously I'm the smartest person here, so everyone can shut up now and I'm going to tell you the answer to the problem. That was not how John Stuart Mill behaved, but, you know, he wasn't lacking in confidence. The thing that I think would hurt him is the way that his name is totally extracted from Harriet Taylor's name. He couldn't have been clearer. Like, when it came to, yes, the key feminist texts, like, you know, the Emancipation of Women, sure. But also, really importantly, when it came to On Liberty, he called it himself, quote, a joint production. That it was written together. We have the evidence. We have the pieces of paper where they finish each other's sentences. We see him start a sentence in pencil and her finish it in pen. We have the communication. We know that it is a joint endeavor, and yet only his name is on the book. When it comes to the plaque, only his name is on the plaque. When it comes to the statue and embankment, only Mill is in the statue. So this joint project, and it's meaningful. I mean, he is the father of modern liberalism, and she is its mother. She was systematically erased over the years. She was vilified, abused, libeled, used as a kind of laundering system, really. So anyone that didn't like, if they liked Mill in general, but didn't like one of his views, would always just go, oh, well, that was just Harriet. You know, that was just something she said. Or she was just this sort of pretty flirt that just repeated the things that he said. He was such a Herod, you know, he was so in love with her that he just couldn't, all of it, just complete nonsense and empirically nonsense. I think the thing that would upset him is the manner in which we talk exclusively about John Stuart Mill and do not talk about John Stuart Mill and Harriet Taylor as a joint unit.
Are there things about his work or their work that have changed the way you think about your own work and maybe even your own life? I mean, are you planning to, you know, conduct educational experiments on your own children, for example?
Yes, yes. If I have children, I'm treating them like tabula rasa. I'll just sit them in a room. I'll just smash them with John Stuart Mill's Political Economy at the age of what, 4, 5? They'll be able to deal with it, I'm sure. And just deny them contact with all other humans. I think it'll work out terribly well.
It worked for John Stuart Mill.
It went for just, well, Isaiah Berlin called it a terrible success. You know, like the world benefited. John Stuart Mill did not really benefit. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I think about it all the time. And specifically, that thing that comes from their experience of ostracization and gossip and social pressure, which is, you know, you look at our society right now, you look at journalism right now, like, I'm a columnist. I get some of the money by writing a column for a newspaper, and that provides some kind of buttress between me and the audience. But I also get income by writing a Substack, by having patrons for our podcast. You know, and there it's a very direct relationship with people who pay you money. So suddenly you become very aware, very acutely aware of where your audience is on an issue and what the consequences might be of not writing what your audience thinks about a particular issue, right? So you have to keep a really sturdy, thick line between you and the world to say, well, hang on, I have to truly believe something on the basis of the evidence that I see it, regardless of what my own tribe thinks, regardless of what my audience thinks, regardless of what my friends or my family think, regardless of how much vitriol I might get, regardless of what it does for my career. You can't ever reach, like, you'll never really get to the end of just knowing that you've perfected that ability to live truly for yourself, to be independent-minded, to be truly autonomous. But you can strive for it. You can fight for it. And I think the lesson to take from Harriet and John is that that's something that you should very much be doing if you want to have a meaningful life.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Blue Plaque Pod. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please subscribe, leave a positive rating and review, and share this episode far and wide with people you think might enjoy it. You can follow the podcast on Instagram and Twitter at Blue Plaque Pod. I'm on Instagram as @CassiaWrites and on Twitter as @CassiaSinclair. This episode was hosted by me, Cassia Sinclair. Editing and audio production by Rob Burney at Made by DBM. The theme tune is Dawning Sprite by Lincoln Davis. If this is the first episode you've listened to, welcome. Other episodes from season one you might enjoy include the novelist Val McDermid talking about the woman once described as the crime writer's crime writer, and Celia Richardson, Director of Communications for the National Trust, who chose the plaque for Octavia Hill, the Trust's co-founder.